Welcome back to another edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. It's Ben Golliver from Blazers Edge. I'm here with Kevin Pelton from Basketball Perspectives, KP2. What is up? The season starts on Tuesday. How pumped are you?
I'm thrilled. And it's been a while since our last Wingcast, so obviously we've had the exciting news about you joining CBSSports.com and blogging there, so congratulations. I've also got an exciting announcement to make that I've been told that because of Shaney's projection for the Blazers this year, I've been voted the new managing editor of ESPNRipCity.com, which should be launching soon.
You delivered that so smoothly, people could not tell that you've been playing that line for 48 hours now, Kevin. That was great. And by the way, your check's in the mail on the plug. Yes, no, CBS is great. Exciting time working with Ken Berger. That dude's the man, man. And obviously Matt Moore, Royce Young, both great guys, been around forever. Writing about basketball, it's a tight little ship we're trying to run. So it's good times.
Yeah, I'm enjoying reading it. And yeah, Berger's sources are incredible. He's got the NBA league office on lock. I don't know why David Stern hasn't traced that down deep throat style.
Yeah, well, when a body ends up off the Atlantic coast, right around New Jersey, we'll know he found out who is leaking all this contraction talk and all the other labor issues that have been going on during this crazy CBA. Jared Bayless got traded, man. Were you blown away by that? Were you surprised? Or did you see it coming? Or what was your initial reaction last night when that went down?
I was surprised by the timing of it. You know, I didn't necessarily expect it now at the last weekend before the start of the regular season. But I can't say when I saw that come across the wire that I was really just taken aback. I mean, you know, I think we've seen some developments moving in this direction. You know, you and I have both been writing to different extents for a while that Johnson might be a better fit for the Blazers' needs at the backup point guard position than Bayless is, just because of their styles of play. And then we've also seen Wesley Matthews capably handling that role at times during the preseason. So it gave the Blazers a lot more options. And then when value was out there for Bayless, I think there was a mentality of let's strike. Well, we can get a first-round pick and a possible lottery pick, depending on how things shake out for this guy.
No doubt. And here's the thing about the timing issue. You know, reading between the lines and some conversations I've had with Rich Cho, you know, he's made it kind of clear, or he's hinted that, you know, there's been trades on the table, trades that he was, you know, considering pretty strongly, like he might pull the trigger on going back, you know, more than a month now, you know, going back really till probably right around, you know, maybe August or mid-August. So he's had, you know, things that he was looking at. Now, is this Bayless trade to New Orleans one of those? You know, maybe New Orleans improved their offer a little bit or solidified their offer as they got closer to the season and realized, hey, we're not going to be very good. We need to get a new player on board here. Or as Dell Demps kind of, you know, increased his power, you know, in his new spot. I'm not sure exactly why the timing was, you know, of this trade was, but I do know he had options on the table. Maybe this was one of them. You know, maybe he wanted to see how the preseason shook out, see exactly how Armon Johnson did against, you know, real live NBA competition, see how the rotation shook out, see how the Rudy situation played out. I think that was probably another big variable timing-wise. Make sure Rudy comes in. He, you know, he participates in practice. He shows up for games. He plays well. All of that makes Bayless a lot more expendable. If Rudy's a huge question mark, if he's flying the coop or doing, you know, God knows what else, has an agent making all these statements on the radio and online, and, you know, he keeps doing that for the entire preseason, then maybe you think, like, hey, that guy's not worth it. We need to keep Bayless around. But there really wasn't room for both of those guys. When you add in Wesley Matthews, you add in Armon Johnson, it's just too crowded. Somebody had to go. That was Bayless. So what did you think about the value that they got for Bayless? I mean, like you said, it could be potentially a lottery pick. In this draft coming up, there's some pretty good players, especially international guys. So if they do choose to use that pick, they should get a pretty good guy in return. Was that enough for Bayless, or were you surprised they were able to get that good of value for Bayless?
Well, it's a little tough to say because of the fact that it's always a guessing game at this point, trying to figure out exactly how good the Hornets are going to be. And the Shaney projection system tends much higher on them than most people, I would say, has them, you know, finishing sixth or so in the Western Conference and in the playoffs, in which case that's not going to be a great pick. But you look at the possibility of ways things could go bad in New Orleans, and You know, I was expecting when I first saw conditional first round pick that that protection would be a little stronger than it was. You know, not necessarily a lot stronger, but not necessarily even a lottery protection completely, in which case I think it would not have been nearly as good a trade for the Blazers. But I was thinking somewhere around top 10, which covers the Hornets in case, you know, things go really poorly, but still gives the Blazers an opportunity to get into the late end of the lottery if New Orleans is one of the last teams out of the playoffs, which I think is where kind of the general conventional wisdom probably has them pegged. So, yeah, I think that, you know, it was a fairly fair trade for both teams, but probably favored the Blazers in terms of overall value. Would you agree with that?
Well, here's the thing about the Hornets real quick, though. I just did a little preview for the Southwest Division for CBS. I actually picked the Hornets to finish last in that division, and I basically boiled down to, you know, you've got two mainstays in Dallas and San Antonio who aren't going anywhere. They're always good every single year. That's just how it works. You've got Memphis, which seems like it may be a team on the rise. You got Marc Gasol developing, Rudy Gay developing, O.J. Mayo developing. And then obviously you've got Houston, who's getting Yao Ming back. They've got some new pieces. It seems like those guys have had some time to work together. Kevin Martin had a pretty solid preseason. So all those teams seem maybe to have a depth advantage over New Orleans. I feel like New Orleans is, you know, one 10-game stretch without Chris Paul away from being really bad. Is that – and I'm surprised that you would say that they were sixth in the Western Conference in your projection.
Well, that's part of one of those things that they're covering for this trade, though, is that stretch where if they are missing Chris Paul, you know, at this point before making this deal, they were counting on Willie Green to step in at the point, or, you know, they just dealt for Curtis Jarrell, so I don't think it's probably going to make the roster at this point, you know, now that you've got three guys who can play the point a little bit. So I think that's one of the value, the things that they were seeing as a value in Bayless. And it makes sense that he was somebody they would be interested in because, you know, clearly Dell Demps has made upgrading that position behind Chris Paul a priority as they've gone out and got Green and Gerald. They signed Mustafa Shakur. They signed Gennaro Pargo, who was injured and then couldn't participate in training camp. And the thought at the time was he would probably be coming back to them. But now that they've got Bayless, maybe they don't need him. So, you know, I think it's an interesting fit for him. I think it's definitely a much better situation for him to showcase his talents, especially if he's playing in a lineup alongside Chris Paul and gets a chance to focus on scoring off the ball instead of having to run an offense and get out of the way like he was at times in Portland as the backup point guard.
You know, I really do like this trade for both teams, you know, in terms of, you know, what, you know, who won or who lost. I think both teams kind of win. I like, for New Orleans, what I really like about it is obviously Bayless is still on his rookie deal. So you're getting a significant talent there, but you're also getting him at a really good price, not only for this year, but for the coming year. You know, and if he turns out to work out great and you're able to keep Chris Paul, or even if you're not, you've got Bayless for a while locked in. And, you know, Monty Williams obviously knows what he's getting with him. He knows how he can use him. So I think they're hitting the ground running there. So I do like the trade for them. For the Blazers, I mean, if you strip away the potential aspect and you look just at production for the last two seasons, I mean, Bayless hasn't really been that lottery quality kind of player for the Blazers. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Jared's game. Love his personality. Love his work ethic. The fit here, you know, was questionable starting in his second season. I think there were some real serious questions about, you know, how does he fit here long term? Is he going to be able to have enough touches so that he can succeed? And can he bring things off the bench when he doesn't get a lot of touches in limited playing time? Is he able to influence games? And, you know, this preseason, he just did not look very good. And I think what ended up really happening was it's a reappraisal of talent. I think that his biggest advocate in the organization through his first two seasons and through the draft process was Kevin Pritchard. I think Kevin Pritchard really, really, really liked Jared Bayless' game. I don't think that should come as a surprise to anyone. I know a couple of the scouts who have been around really like Jared Bayless' game, too. They expect him to, you know, improve and progress his all-around basketball game over the next couple of years significantly. I mean, they still have, you know, big expectations for Jared's game. But I think, you know, Rich Cho came in here, surveyed the landscape and said, you know, kind of without any sentimentality, without, you know, any connection to that player because, you know, he wasn't involved in the draft process. Indeed, he passed on Bayless to get Russell Westbrook in Oklahoma City. So, you know, he was well aware of Bayless' game, you know, going back all the way to college, probably all the way to high school. And I think he reassessed the situation, you know, looked at it and said, hey, you know, Jared Bayless is not what we need here. And, you know, he didn't have a real problem pulling the trigger on it, clearly, because, you know, he did it right before the season started when, you know, generally you're trying to make sure, you know, all the waves are smooth. But the timing was a little surprising, you know, just because, You know, you don't have everybody really healthy. I mean, you've had some nicks. You've got Marcus Camby, obviously, who's kind of been dealing with some things. You've got Wesley Matthews dealing with an Achilles. You know, Brandon hasn't really been playing super hard. So, you know, there's still some question marks, I think, and legitimate questions about how much he's going to be able to give you production-wise. So to give away an asset right now and not receive a short-term asset in return, I think there's a little bit of a risk factor there. And so I think that's probably why I was a little bit surprised by the timing. But I think it was a calculated risk. And I think long-term, the deal makes a lot of sense. I think it really opens the, you know, Blazers up flexibility-wise. I mean, now you've got two first-round picks going into draft night, so you can package those and move up, sort of like Oklahoma City did to get Cole Aldrich this season. Or, you know, you can ship those off for players to fit in, you know, role players if you need to. You've got the extra roster spot, so you can make a decision on Patty Mills. If you want to save a little bit of money, you can waive him. If you want to keep him to keep Paul Allen happy, then you can do that now too. So I think you also get the trade exception, which may come in handy, you know, sometime at the trade deadline. Somebody's trying to dump salary. Maybe you can pick up a rotation player in that, $2.3 million slot. So I think he's got some options. I think he's got some different things he could do. And I think the Blazers, I think he was probably feeling really locked in, just given the cap situation of the Blazers, given how many large long-term deals they're going to have, not only now with, you know, Roy and Aldridge, but also future ones, you know, anticipated for Batum and for Greg Oden, assuming Greg Oden never plays again. Just kidding. But they're going to have a lot of money locked into those guys, and any flexibility is, you know, of paramount importance for the Blazers at this point. I think trading Bayless gives you a little bit of flexibility, not an overwhelming amount, but enough that you can do something with it, whether it's, you know, at the trade deadline or at the draft or even in the next year.
Well, I think John Hollinger raised an interesting point about the flexibility aspect of this trade in terms of pointing out what it could do for the Blazers if you're trying to make a bigger move at the deadline and you're going out there with, you know, a couple of expiring contracts, potentially Andre Miller's if you're getting a point guard return, and then also Joel Frazbilla's. Then you've got a couple of first-round picks to play with. You've got, you know, some of this year's rookies potentially in play. There's a lot of assets there to choose from for another team that might be looking to move a veteran. I think that an obvious target, you know, that we've talked about a lot in the past is Chauncey Billups from Denver. If they decide to blow that thing up, you know, that possibility of getting a lottery pick to go along with their own could be very enticing for the Nuggets. But, you know, to go back from the reappraisal of talent, and, you know, I think, like we said at first, that the play of the other options at point guard probably had a lot to do with this. So, you know, I only saw Armin Johnson the one time because the preseason games were not televised. What can you tell me about what you saw from him during the preseason?
Well, you know, his preseason was really similar to what he did in the summer league, and I assume it's really similar to what he did in college too. I mean, the first word that comes to mind really is just solid. I mean, he goes out there and he plays really tough defense. He picks this guy up three-quarter court almost, you know, instinctively by himself. He wants to just get up in his man and move his feet. He played the team defense pretty well. You know, when it comes to high screen and rolls and whatnot, he's really fighting through, trying to get over the top when he can. He's following his man through. He's really quick. On offense, it's been up and down shooting, which is kind of to be expected because his jumper still needs a lot of work. But, you know, he did have one preseason game. I forget who the opponent was. Might have been Golden State or might have been Denver. It's one of the two preseason games in the Rose Garden where he really put together a nice all-around offensive game. He had a runner going to the basket, a three-pointer. He had a really pretty pull-up jumper, right, sort of in the elbow area. So he's done a lot of different things, you know, shooting-wise. He's a really good passer. He places his passes really well. He's also calm on the ball. So, you know, even if there's ball pressure, he just kind of surveys, keeps his head up, protects the ball. He hasn't had a lot of turnovers. Obviously, he's known for that. Limiting his turnovers, he did a really good job in that in Las Vegas. So, and I don't think it was anything really overwhelming. I think it was just solid. I think he's the kind of player who Nate McMillan can look at and say, hey, I feel comfortable with him, you know, coming in for a quick run in the second quarter, quick run in the third quarter. He's not going to leak points. He's not going to make dumb mistakes. He's not going to have, you know, careless passes. And he's going to play really solid defense, and he's going to bother some people. You know, I did that feature on Stephen Curry for CBS Sports, and I asked him. And, you know, Stephen Curry didn't even know Armon Johnson's name, but he's like, that guy was really up in my face. He was pressuring me three-quarters court. You know, he was trying to take me out of the offense, and he kind of gave him a little credit for being such an aggressive defender. And actually, Curry had 8 turnovers in that game. Now, they weren't all caused by Armon Johnson, but – you know, that kind of pressure, you know, gets to young guys. there's a lot of young point guards in this league, so it's a good asset to have. I don't think he's going to play a ton of minutes here in Portland right off the bat. I just think he's still a ways away. I don't think he can, you know, reliably shoot that jumper. You know, teams like Ty Lawson was sagging off Armand Johnson, like, all the way down to the low block when Armand was up at the top of the three-point line. I mean, he's just completely not even caring about him just because, you know, they're going to make him beat you with his shot, and he can't do that at this point. So I think more – I don't think Johnson really – I don't think this is a case of the Blazers getting rid of Bayless because they have Johnson. I think it's a case of the entire – backcourt rotation just not having enough minutes to get value out of Bayless, if that makes sense. I really do think they're going to go a lot three guard with Wesley Matthews, Brandon Roy, Nicholas Batum. I think that's going to eat up a larger chunk of minutes than most people expected. I also think they're going to use Rudy more, either alongside Brandon or, you know, alongside Andre in a second unit. So, you know, again, that there's question marks, you know, is Bayless the kind of guy who's going to really mesh with Rudy and get him going? You know, there was times this preseason where it looked like he was. There were times this preseason where, you know, Bayless was kind of just doing his own thing, going to the basket, running the pick and rolls, and not looking for anybody. So I think, you know, it was a combination of factors. Obviously, Armand Johnson kind of pushed it over the edge, but I do think the fact that you have a guy like Elliot Williams still here lurking, who's not as good maybe as Bayless, but has the potential to be sort of in that same career track, that, you know, what's the value of keeping Bayless relative to who else you have on your team? He's just not as unique. His skill set isn't as valuable as it used to be maybe even last year or the year before.
Well, yeah, I think if you talked about Rudin, and I think if he plays the way that he did during the preseason, you can't keep him out of the lineup because, you know, we've seen him be an asset. He was one of the league's better reserve wings his rookie season, and it's still kind of inexplicable to me why he didn't play that well during last season, whether it was just his mental state of mind, you know, being homesick and not feeling like he fit in, and his confidence waned towards the end of the season. Whatever that factor was, he seems to have moved past it. And, you know, sometimes maybe the whole experience of, you know, demanding to go home and demanding a trade and all those sort of things, you know, once you go through it and you know that's not happening, you know, maybe there's a point at which he becomes more committed and more effective as a player.
You know, I really liked what Scholes wrote on FanHouse about the whole catharsis process, that maybe his media day performance might have given him, because the switch seemed to flip. And I wrote about this a little bit, and I got some play in some other places too, the idea that, you know, Rudy came around mood-wise pretty quickly after media day. There was media day, and then there was one practice where he was, like, weirdly held out and off to the side and supposedly had an injury, and they shielded him from the media. And it was this really bizarre scene. You know, it seemed like it was had the potential to kind of, you know, pop off into something, you know, even more extended. But then after that one practice, from basically, you know, the Wednesday of the media day week on, Rudy's mood, like, did a 180. And it was, you know, all of a sudden he was back to sort of how he was his rookie year. He seemed really, you know, much more happier. He was staying after practice longer to get up more shots. You know, he was kind of palling around with Patty Mills, as Sam Amick wrote, and he was playing really, really, really well during all of the home preseason games. I mean, he just shot the lights out every chance he could. So I think there might have been something to the idea that he had something to get off his chest. You know, he had a really hard time maybe leaving Spain to come back to Portland, not having his situation resolved and maybe not getting his way like he had hoped he would. And I think maybe he got it all out of his system on media day. It took 24 hours to kind of, you know, decompress from the huge headlines that went all, you know, internationally, basically, after that, you know, nearly tear-filled performance. And, you know, he pulled it together and he's looked great since. So he does seem pretty happy. You know, I wonder, you know, if he's still a trade asset, you know, at the deadline. I mean, you talked about some of the packages they could throw together. I wonder if, you know, Rudy, if he plays hard until January, maybe, you know, his contract, which is obviously not huge, and his skill set off the bench might be attractive to another team. But maybe he has enough minutes here and a big enough role here to stay happy.
Well, from that perspective, I'm not sure that there's a lot of people that the Blazers shouldn't potentially view as assets, depending on what the move ends up being. I mean, I think that there's, you know, maybe three, four guys that you would put in that group that you wouldn't move, and pretty much everyone else is available if it's the missing piece that makes you into a true contending team.
So what do you make of Cho here? I mean, are you, you know, he's now made his first move. It seems to be kind of sort of a quintessential, you know, Oklahoma City kind of style move. Do you think he's settling in? I mean, do you feel like this was sort of a reputation defining move, or a kind of a you know, stamp on his the start of his era here by trading Bayless? Or do you think, you know, he's just doing what any GM would do?
Well, I think it fits in with that general, you know, like you said, the Oklahoma City style. And frankly, it's not that different, I think, from a move that Kevin Pritchard might make, you know, except for, as you talked about, being sort of attached to one of his guys, whereas Cho doesn't bring that same attachment to the Blazers roster. But, you know, getting value, getting a first-round pick, and having, you know, the chance to be active in the draft, it's not that dissimilar maybe from, you know, what they did with moving Martell Webster for the pick that became Luke Babbitt, and then also Ryan Gomes' contract at the draft. So, you know, I don't think it tells us a ton about, you know, the bigger picture direction that Joe wants to take the team, but it does tell you that he's going to have that same kind of aggressiveness in terms of pursuing value and stockpiling assets.
No doubt. All right, let's move on to the other move that he made recently, which was apparently agreeing to sign Argentinian big man Fabricio Oberto. He was you know, a member of the Spurs for a while, and then he, I think, bounced to Washington last year for spot play. Was that right?
Yeah, spent last year with the Wizards.
And then now he was kind of hiding out, you know, over the summer, and was really late to agree to terms to play with an NBA team. It's not totally clear how many offers or how much interest there was NBA-wise. He had some pretty clear interest overseas. You know, just from the emails I've been getting from the media in Argentina, clearly he's, you know, very well respected down there, because they want to know every last detail, you know, instantly about, you know, what his situation is here in Portland. So he's obviously got that going for him. You know, I excerpted your sort of critical rundown of Oberto, where he stands at this point in his career, and it wasn't super nice. But then, you know, you were talking to me on G-Chat, and you said something along the lines of, well, he's better than Juwan Howard was last year. So where do you stand on the Oberto signing? What does he bring to the table for the Blazers? Is it a thumbs up or thumbs down, and is he really better than Juwan Howard?
I mean, I think, you know, you have to judge this in the context of the options that are available. And when you're looking for a legitimate seven-footer who's free to sign on the eve of the NBA season, your choices are awfully limited. I would say that Josh Boone was probably my favorite guy who was out there, although I can see why the Blazers wouldn't have wanted him for this role, you know, where there's a possibility that Oberto might not see any action after the first couple weeks of the season if Joel Frazier and Craig Yeadon both get back on a reasonable timeline and then are able to stay healthy the rest of the way. You know, basically you're signing him just for this couple-week period. So you need someone who's going to be able to accept a backup role potentially after that, or, you know, comes in with the understanding that they're not a long-term part of this franchise and are just, you know, just being asked in to play a role and provide some size in the middle for the next couple of weeks. So in terms of doing that, you know, I think Oberto is capable. You know, two or three years ago, he was really a pretty good center, very solid player. We're not that far removed from him being the starting center on a championship team back in 2007 with San Antonio. But he's also, you know, he's 35 now, and he's not the same player that he once was. He understands his limitations, so I think that's where you'll see a similarity with Juwan Howard. Remains a very efficient offensive player. In fact, if I recall correctly, I believe he led the league in shooting percentage last year, depending on where you set the bar in terms of, you know, number of shot attempts needed to qualify for that. But he shot a very high percentage from the field. The issues are that at this stage of his career, he's not especially mobile defensively, and he's definitely not going to create his own shot to the extent that he ever really did that. So you're thinking of kind of, you know, a poor man's Prisbilla, not the same kind of defensive presence, but similar on offense. You know, that's kind of the range, I think, that you're expecting. And in terms of just providing, you know, a stopgap seven-footer, I think that he'll work out well for the Blazers.
So what you're saying is Nate's going to put him under do not shoot unless you're within 3 feet of the rim rules. I mean, as soon as he shows up, that's going to be like part of the contract.
Oberto already seems to be under that, whether that's Saunders' rule or not, so Nate may not need to lay down the law there.
Okay, so when it comes to Oberto, what you're describing, you know, in the short term, you know, solid backup for Marcus Camby. Now, let's say, you know, these minor injuries continue to happen to Camby, and, you know, there's a pretty good chance that'll probably continue to happen, knowing the kind of player he is, knowing that, you know, the person he is at this stage of his career. Let's say Camby's out for a game, you know, early November, so Prisbill is not back yet. Who do you think, are you going to start Oberto next to Aldridge, or are you going to start Cunningham next to Aldridge and use Oberto as your third man no matter what?
Is the question what I would do, or is the question what Nate McMillan would do?
Well, the question, let's do both. What would you do?
Yeah, I would go with Cunningham. You know, I think we've seen where, against certain front courts, the lack of size with Cunningham and Aldridge can be an issue, and it's not a real physical, tough front court, certainly, and you're giving up length. But, you know, it's Cunningham is a very effective player, so I think one of the silver linings of sorts in the Jeff Pendergraph injury is that, you know, it's not a bad thing to get him a little bit more playing time early in the season. But knowing Nate's philosophy and how much value he places on size at that position, I'm pretty sure that Oberto would be that guy, at least, you know, at the start of the game, with Cunningham maybe playing down the stretch and potentially getting more minutes ultimately at center than Oberto, but just not in that starting role.
That makes sense. And here's another good question about Oberto for you. And by the way, I agree. I'd probably start Cunningham, but I also do think that Nate might, you know, maybe after sort of a getting used to everybody's, you know, feeling out period, you know, maybe a couple of weeks, I think Oberto might step into that backup starting role if Camby goes down. But can you quantify for people, you know, I know Shaney hasn't been huge on Pendergraph's overall game, mostly because of his defensive liabilities. You know, let's project and say, you know, Pendergraph was maybe going to play about 15 or 20 minutes until Prisbilla and Odin get back, you know, in that backup big man role. Let's plug Oberto in for Pendergraph's minutes. I mean, what percentage of production is Oberto, of Pendergraph's production, is Oberto going to give you? I mean, how much are you losing by having Pendergraph go out with this injury and replacing him with Oberto? You're losing 10% of what he was able to do. Is it even? Is it 30%? You know, is he more productive than Pendergraph, would you expect? I mean, how would you quantify the difference between Pendergraph and Oberto now that Pendergraph's gone down?
I would say 85 to 90%. I don't think it's a big drop off. And part of that is probably familiarity with the Blazers. But, you know, actually their skill sets are kind of similar, even though they're at opposite ends of the career, where their career, Pendergraph's a better rebounder, and I think that's where the difference lies. Oberto is probably a bit better as a system defender, despite the fact that he's not a big-time shot blocker and not especially mobile. And offensively, again, similar philosophies of not shooting a lot and shooting high-percentage shots when they do get opportunities. So when you consider the fact that you're only talking about like 15 minutes a game most nights if Camby stays healthy, I'm not even sure the difference is a win in the standings over the period of time that we expect Prisbilla to be out. You know, I don't think it's ultimately going to matter very one way or another on the final record.
See, that's amazing. That's the real value, I think, of when you look at these statistics. It's a guy like Pendergraph is sort of the case study for sentimentality, you know. He's on Twitter all day, every day, talking to all of his fans. Great locker room guy. He's out there, you know, before games, doing the cheers, having you know, dancing around, everybody surround him. You know, he's really good friends with Nate McMillan's son. They played in college together. You know, he's done everything the team could possibly want from him in terms of, you know, public relations. He goes on courtside with Mike Barrett and Mike Rice anytime. You know, he volunteers to go on courtside, basically. He's all over, you know, any media you could possibly expect. You know, that's he's there. He wants to represent the organization the best way possible. And you realize that at the end of the day, you know, no matter how many connections he makes with fans, all that other stuff, if you're the general manager and you are making, you know, business decisions on the basketball court like Rich Cho had to, if the difference between Pendergraph and Oberto isn't going to affect a single win statistics-wise, it's not so hard to waive him or release him if he gets a season-ending injury, is it? But yeah, when you think about it and you talk to the fans, and I have talked to a lot of people about it, they were stunned that the Blazers would let Pendergraph go. How's he going to rehab his knee? What's his, you know, future medical course going to be? You know, why would they abandon someone who's been so good to the organization? And it seems like you have a big difference of opinion in terms of how you treat Pendergraph when you look at it from the business side or the stats side, and when you look at it from the fan side. Do you think that's a value that statistics can play for executives in the NBA?
You know, I think that they offer the chance for objectivity in particular. And, you know, it's easy to, like you said, get attached to guys because of their personalities and lose sight of what is most important at the end of the day in terms of performance on the court. But, you know, I don't think that necessarily statistics are telling you anything different about Pendergraft than you got from watching him last season. You know, his liabilities defensively were fairly evident watching the team, I think. And I think the scouting perspective would say something similar. You know, it's just a tough break for a guy to have a career like that, especially in a situation where you already have two players who are down at the same position. I mean, that's what really cost Pendergraft. You know, if you were completely healthy, you could afford to potentially carry that one injured player.
You're saying that, you know, stats aren't going to tell you that much different than the scout's eye or, you know, watching his play might tell you about Pendergraft. But here's my question, though. Would Kevin Pritchard have even considered waiving Jeff Pendergraft after that injury? Or would he have been in the hospital room massaging Jeff's knee, holding his hand through the surgery, telling everybody that he can't wait till Jeff comes back on the court? I mean, don't you think he would have, you know, taken a completely different approach to it and maybe – you know, overlooked some of the scouting or overlooked some of the numbers and played it differently than maybe Rich Cho has?
You know, I think that's possible, but it's kind of unfair to speculate what would have happened in the hypothetical that he never faced. Because, I mean, you know, we saw how emotional he was about Greg Oden's injury, for example, last year, but it's not like there was ever a question of, are we going to have to cut Greg Oden so that we can, you know, get another center and field a competitive lineup for the first two of the season. So, you know, sentimentality is harder in the face of an actual decision and something that's going to make a difference potentially on the floor.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's not really fair to speculate. I understand. I'm just, my whole point was that I think that, you know, it is possible even for guys who use analytics and look at statistics to let, you know, emotion or sentimentality or attachment to players get in the way of making decisions that might come across as cutthroat and ruthless. And I think that part of that in Pritchard's case, I think part of that is because he kind of talked himself into a corner by playing up the whole culture thing and playing up treating guys the right way and that whole aspect of selling the organization from a marketing standpoint and trying to get fans back in the door. And when you say all of those things for, you know, years and years and years, it's really difficult to cut across the other direction and do something like wave a guy like Pendergraft, right? And I think that one luxury that Rich Cho has is he hasn't really had to come in here and sell tickets as a general manager. And some GMs have to do that and some don't. And, you know, given, you know, the popularity of the team currently, the success it's had over the last couple of seasons, that's been one nice benefit of coming in when he did for Cho, is that he can focus, you know, strictly on the best business and strictly on the best basketball moves and let everything else kind of play out. And I think he's done that. I don't think it's his personality really to pander to fans too much or to, you know, to get out there and broadcast, you know, positive, you know, hopeful messages about the team's future. I think he's very much a focused and hardworking kind of guy, but he's in a situation that allows him to be like that. I'm not sure if he came in here 3 years ago, he would have been able to do that. Does that make sense?
Well, there was an element of building back trust in the team that had been certainly lost on a lot of different levels in the organization, not only within the basketball staff, but, you know, Pritchard became sort of the visible face of that whole effort. And I think to the extent that are still those same questions, or were when Cho took over, they were strictly related to, you know, Kevin Pritchard's departure and how that played out. So as soon as you had a solid guy at the GM and someone that the fans could get behind, those were sort of resolved and everybody moved past it. But, you know, I mean, I think Cho has kept up a lot of the things. Like, you know, you talked on Blazer's Edge about the gathering at the practice facility last week and how far above and beyond he went in terms of making you and the other people who were there feel like your time was really valued and that the front office wanted to let you in on what they were doing.
Well, it was crazy, man. That practice facility tour is nuts. Well, you kind of got the feeling like, hey, Rich didn't have anywhere else to be, you know, like his family is still not here in Portland and he's, you know, living alone down on the waterfront. And I imagine he probably spends a lot of time in his office late night where he's one of the few guys in the building. And I kind of got the sense, especially towards the end of it, was getting on like 8:30 and this event had started at 6 where we toured the entire facility, put all the fans through a workout. He had dinner with people. He showed people a spreadsheet. Presentation on PowerPoint. He showed a video presentation. He invited everyone into his office and he literally let fans sit in the GM chair and take pictures of themselves. So it's like, if that's not the fantasy GM players biggest desire. I don't know what would be. He's showing off his big board and how he puts together proposed trades. I mean, it was really like as all access as you could possibly imagine. But by the end of it, I was kind of thinking like, I think this guy is getting out of it as much as all of the fans are too. I think he really wanted to have that experience where he could be, surrounded by and chatting with and talking to fans. And I thought he made a real point of doing that throughout the entire time, coming up to people one-on-one, talking to them, posing for pictures, asking them, where do you live and what part of the city and how long have you been a fan, that kind of stuff. I mean, it was clear he was getting a big benefit out of it, and I think it was a real thrill for him because obviously he put a lot of time into planning an event that, it came off as kind of a surprise for everyone who was there. So, I think you're right. I think he is trying to do some of those things, but it's just not really his style to do it so publicly. I think, a discreet event like that where, the fans were there with cameras and, I was there and, a couple of the PR staff was there to take pictures, but, there was obviously no TV trucks there or anything like that. And I think that's, kind of his style. But, we are coming up here on the start of the season on Tuesday. Blazers host the Phoenix Suns in a playoff rematch at the Rose Garden. Phoenix has looked terrible during this preseason, so hopefully that means a opening night win for the Blazers. Obviously, Portland would love to see that. Are there any late-breaking changes in terms of your projections for the Blazers? Obviously you've been doing updates every time a player moves or every time someone gets signed or somebody gets waived, rotations change, you're adjusting your computer model. What is the final projection for the Blazers say? Is it better or worse than the projection you gave us on the last Wingcast? And, where are you on the Blazers right now? Are you feeling optimistic? It seems like they've been getting a lot of second place in the Northwest Division, fourth or fifth overall from a lot of the experts. In terms of the Western Conference, where do you see the Blazers?
Well, I think by the time that this Wingcast goes up, the final projections will be up on basketballprospectus.com. There was a brief period of time right after the Bayless trade where increasing Rudy Fernandez's minutes to take over a lot of that playing time lost with Bayless took the Blazers even higher than they originally were. But now that I've got Armand Johnson slotted up a little bit and accounted for Fabricio Oberto, even though I hate putting players in there before they're officially signed, with that they end up right around where they were originally. Now I believe 55.7 wins is the projection, which is still far and away the best in the Western Conference and second in the league behind the Miami Heat. As far as subjectively, we're going to do our subjective picks on Basketball Prospectus on Tuesday. And I've sort of been agonizing over who to pick in the Western Conference. People that have seen Pro Basketball Prospectus 2010-11 and are seeing projections know that we're not real high on the Lakers. And I think this is the year that somebody knocks them off in the Western Conference playoffs. But I'm still not sure who to say that's going to be and who to pick to come out of the Western Conference in our subjective picks. I don't know that I'm ready yet to go with the Blazers in that spot. And I think there's a few different teams I'm considering. So I would say that I have them as the favorite in the Northwest Division. Our projection for Denver is very good, but that doesn't take into account the possibility that they could trade Carmelo Anthony tomorrow, for all we know, and become a totally different team. So I think the Portland is favorites in division and right in that mix to win the conference, but I'm not sure I'm ready to say they're the favorite to win the conference. I'm not going that far.
But you really want to, though. But you just can't bring yourself to do it. But you want to. I can hear it in your voice. You want to say, you want to come on and say, hey, Blazers number one in the West, don't you?
Well, I mean, that's going to play well at ESPNRipCity.com, so.
Well, on that note, KP, that's probably a good place to end it. I think people will be excited to hear that news. So ESPNRipCity.com, BasketballPerspectives.com. You got the book out now. How's it going, by the way, book sales?
They're going excellent. We already have more PDF downloads than all of last year. It's selling steadily on Amazon.com. We've been right up there among the top hoop books, competing with the Free Darko Crew's new history book. I think once that's officially released and no longer on pre-sale, they're just going to dominate us. But, so far, so good.
I will just tell people that, if you get the PDF copy, it looks awesome on an iPad. Other tablets look sweet. Same thing goes for that Free Darko book. Looks awesome on an iPad. Just got the hard copy of that Free Darko book last week. Looks great. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, it's terrific. I can't wait to dive in and start going through that.
Yeah, I mean, it's real difficult to figure out a better way to spend $30 than to buy your book, buy Free Darko's book, and just call it good. I mean, you got enough basketball information to take you through the first 2-3 weeks of the season. You can learn about all these sort of random players when trades happen, signings happen, just like, you know, they did, just like they did over the weekend. You have instant access to that information. If you get the PDF copy, you can actually just hit a, you know, a control F and find Oberto immediately right off the top. You know more about him than all your friends do within 30 seconds. I mean, it's a an amazing resource. With Free Darko's book, they got some awesome art in there, some really intelligent essays from Scholes. You know, I've gotten through probably the first half of the book, but he goes through some early history of the basketball, what makes the game so great, how it started, what some of the crazy rule changes and inventions were along the way, how the court was designed and shaped. I mean, it's really, really, really interesting stuff. Couldn't recommend that book highly enough. All right, we're done selling books, KP. Good to hear from you. I will see you on Tuesday. I became more curious. Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, my own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer.